Good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, Finn at OffbeatOregon.com, and this is the Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Thank you for loading me down and queuing me up, and I hope you enjoy this show. If you know what a fish wheel is, you may be a little surprised to hear that they're making a comeback. You may be even more surprised to hear that that comeback is to save the fish. Once blamed for wiping out the enormous Columbia River salmon run, the mechanical salmon harvesters bring fish unhurt into the waiting hands of conservationists who count and tag and release them. The story was first published on November 1st of 2008, so it's one of the very earliest ones published. Here we go. Fish wheels have a bad reputation, but they may be making a comeback in a different role. For about the past 10,000 years, Indian tribe members have taken big nets to bits of the Columbia River where the water runs fast and used them to scoop out salmon dinners. When the industrialized Europeans came in the mid-1800s, they knew a good thing when they saw it. The Indians caught so much salmon so quickly that some enterprising Europeans actually quickly realized that they could make a killing scooping out fish, canning them up, and selling them cheap. But not being inclined to stand around on fishing platforms as the sun beat down on them, they mechanized the method. And thus the fish wheel came to the Columbia. It's a sort of like a paddle wheel with baskets on the tips, with a wooden flume built downstream to divert a big cross-section of river into its path. The current turns the wheel, the baskets scoop out all the fish that swim through the flume, and the cannery built nearby puts them all into little flat cans. Really quite a clever innovation. Just to give you an idea of how many fish these things scooped out of the river, one, built in 1887 about 5 miles north of the Dalles, pulled 418,000 pounds of fish out of the river in 1906 alone. By that time, there were more than 75 others like it lining the shores of the river where it ran fast. Meanwhile, fleets of gill netters based out of little fishing towns near Astoria were also pulling vast numbers of fish out of the lower Columbia, where the water runs slow and deep, to be processed at canneries down there. Not surprisingly, the operators started noticing the catches dwindling as the early 1900s wore on. But their response was to blame each other for the fading of the fishery. No one yet realized it was actually a collapse they were dealing with, and perhaps it wasn't yet. The two groups, fish wheel operators and gill netters, sponsored competing ballot measures in 1908, one banning fish wheels and the other virtually banning gill netting. Both measures passed and were blocked from enforcement by courts. Nice to see some things haven't changed in 100 years, isn't it? By 1926, it was clear the fish were pretty much gone, and the state legislature hastened to slam the barn door after the horse by banning the fish wheels. Gill netters soldiered on. A greatly diminished fleet still plies the waters of the lower Columbia, but the catch is relatively paltry. A huge blow was dealt to the already suffering fishery a few years later when Grand Coulee Dam was built without fish ladders, cutting off a lot of fish from their spawning grounds. Today, most of the fish caught in the Columbia are raised in commercial hatcheries. But the fish wheel may be due for a comeback. On the Okanagan River, the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife is using fish wheels to count fish, not can them. The baskets scoop juvenile fish out of the water without snaring or hooking them, and because it all happens so fast, they don't have a chance to hurt themselves flailing around in an underwater net. Once on deck, they can be logged, tagged with tiny electronic tags, and sent on their way to the ocean, none the worse for wear. Or at least, not much the worse. It's an interesting new positive role for an old technology that many people think is responsible for a goodly share of the collapse of the biggest salmon fishery on the West Coast. Well, that's our show for today. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. In addition to this podcast, it includes a weekly newspaper column, a series of live history shows, a daily RSS feed to catch in your smartphone newsreader, a Facebook page, and a couple other minor components too, YouTube channel, that kind of thing. Photographs and other visual goodies that go with today's show are on offbeatoregon.com, where you will also find full citations to the sources for this story. The podcast is covered under a Creative Commons license. For details of that, see offbeatoregon.com/cc. Our theme music is an Atlas String Band track, atlasstringband.com, and it was written by Carmen Ficarra. I do Offbeat Oregon History for the fun of it, and to learn things. So I don't sell advertising and I don't ask for donations. But if you do enjoy Offbeat Oregon history and you'd like to support it, you can always pick up a copy of my book. If you enjoy the show, I can pretty much guarantee that you'll enjoy my book. It's called Wicked Portland. It's published by the History Press in 2012, and you can pick a copy up at a community bookstore near you, or you can order a signed copy from the store link at offbeatoregon.com. The book sells for $20. Finally, if you ever happen to be in Corvallis, drop me a line. We can grab a cup of coffee and talk about history. I'm at finn@offbeatoregon.com, or you can tweet at me, @offbeatoregon. Our next show will be coming up at around 6 a.m. tomorrow morning. And until then, go and fill up the rest of today with good stuff. Bye now.